Support for WPR comes from Tomorrow River Community Virtual School, delivering Waldorf-inspired live virtual lessons to grades 4K through 8th, open to all Wisconsin students. More is at trcvs.org.
Support for WPR comes from the Wisconsin DNR. Preventing food waste and composting scraps and uneaten veggies, grains, and fruit can help the environment. More dnr.wi.gov by searching food waste.
All publications masquerading under the name of ragtime are not the genuine article. Will be better known when these exercises are studied. That real ragtime of the higher class is rather difficult to play. It's a painful truth which most pianists have discovered. Syncopations are no indication of light or trashy music.
Although traditional ragtime may be associated with leisure, respectable or otherwise, in his School of Ragtime, Scott Joplin insisted that ragtime was music to be taken seriously and played as its composers specified. Well, that was ragtime practitioner U.B. Blake reading, by the way. We're going to delve into some of the traditional and more recent forms of ragtime. I'm Norman Gilliland, and this is University of the Air. With me is Carlos Moser, composer, pianist, pedagogue, and co-founder of the original Hyperion Oriental Foxtrot Orchestra. Welcome back to University of the Air, Carlos.
Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure. I mean, I didn't even mention in that introduction your vast operatic background.
36 years of teaching opera at the university. Yes.
Just 36, did you say? Well, be that as it may, we're going to go into this fascinating, in some ways, short-lived form of music called ragtime.
Yes. It bloomed in the early 1900s and has been revived, but any attempt now at playing it is certainly a deliberate nod to the past.
And, you know, ragtime, of course, means ragged time.
Ragged syncopations. I think Rick Mackey had called a continuum of syncopation that had come from the Caribbean and how it got introduced. And the rags, certainly made famous by Scott Joplin, are always somewhat syncopated.
Of course, there's been syncopation in music for a long time. And
absolutely.
Beethoven uses it in, you know, one of his sonatas at
sure.
least.
So
yeah,
that's
the second 32nd piano sonata
right.
of Beethoven,
that's
which
right.
always fascinated me with that kind of boogie-woogie quality to it. Where did that come from? But syncopation, then there was something added then by, what, the 1890s when ragtime comes along.
Well, Scott Joplin, of course, not only was a genius, but he had a good classical training with a German teacher. And I think his ears certainly picked up on the harmonic sequences, the dynamics of the chordal structures, and he knew the fixed forms like the marches, which were so popular, and when his music could be played anywhere. And at first, of course, it was associated with only the lower life, but rags certainly became immensely popular in the early 1900s.
So he had this combination of classical training and somewhere in the air hearing these sounds that sort of coalesced in Scott Joplin's imagination.
Yes, indeed. Uh-huh. That syncopation, ragged, whether it's the dancing or not, certainly the African influence. But he knew his strict forms. The rags, the piano rags, are always three strains of 16 bars each. This is almost invariable. Now, they can be repeated, and in classic numbers like his Maple Leaf Rag, which is 1899, immensely famous and justly so. He has the first strain with the syncopation. You hear the syncopation right away, and it lasts two. But then also a very typical form is by the third strain he goes, he takes the time. And goes into the subdominant. And this release into the subdominant was a well-known psychological fact, I could say, to the composers.
So the subdominant has what relationship to where
the subdominant,
we started?
It sounds almost kinky, but it isn't. It's, it's only the tonic and then the dominant. And the subdominant is just one step lower. So we're going from this key. Philip Sousa, for instance, in his Stars and Stripes Forever. That release into the subdominant is very satisfying, and it is used an awful lot in the rags.
It's just the mystery of music, isn't it? How
it is.
One sound has this effect on almost everybody who hears it.
Yeah, and they don't know what it is, and they don't care, but it works. Mm-hmm. And I think in every single one of my rags today, the third strain will go into the subdominant. Sometimes it goes from minor, as in Balcom's
Graceful Ghost.
And then you feel that release into
something
the
sublime about it, isn't there?
Something absolutely wonderful about it. And so Scott Joplin also could, he was a good pianist, and he could throw in, for instance, the obligatory arpeggio. And this comes up in many rags. For instance, in James Scott rag, which I will play soon, with a slight syncopation, but still a release in a way, often on the seventh or eighth bar. So these techniques were available and they were exploited, always with syncopation in the rags. Now, it started first in the African American community, and not only Scott Joplin, James Scott, he met later, and as I think Rudy Blesch says, if Joplin was the Chopin of rags, James Scott was the Liszt. And he does have certain extensions, pianistic extensions, which Joplin does not have.
They say they all played ragtime. That was Rudy Blesch's book.
Yes, right.
It talks about them.
And that's where the revival came up. It's amazing that people like, Dick Hayman, did you say?
Dick Hayman, yeah.
Dick Hayman. And even Balcom wrote his Graceful Ghost in 71. I think of the big popularization of rags with the movie The Sting.
No, it was, what, about 74 or so?
Somewhere there, mm-hmm. Somewhere in the early 70s, and the Blesch bringing out. So its popularity certainly was brought back. And to me, within the context of the original Hyperion Oriental Foxtrot Orchestra, Rick Mackey brought them to me. And what I liked was what not only Scott Joplin, but Artie Matthews says, don't fake. Play what's written. These are artistic pieces. These are not jazz in any sense. The only thing, and they have comparatively few dynamic marks or no retards, except, of course, in Scott Joplin's famous Solace, where there's a fermata, actually. But very few dynamics. When they do repeat and ask for a change of dynamics, it's usually the opposite of the classical. The classical waltz plays something and then the echo,
right.
The famous echo.
Sure, yes.
And in Scott's, it's the other way around. Piano first time, second.
It's almost like a show tune where you start out with the soloist and then the chorus.
That's
kicks
right.
In.
It's an intensification.
The big reprise.
Yeah. The only other thing that I sometimes allow myself, and this goes all the way back to Bach, is loosening the tempo. When Bach writes a triplets, and then he wants the first two parts of the triplets alternating with the. Let's see. He might sometimes write a dotted eighth and 16th, which is not exact. He wants us to relax the 16th. And so perhaps also sometimes in the rags, they could have been. We can. You see what I mean?
Yes, indeed.
Perhaps a second time.
Different effect.
Yeah, it's a different effect, and I think it's legitimate, but it's not done too often. This is whether we become Werktreu, mm-hmm. Do we do exactly every crescendo that is marked or something? No pedalings are marked. So we have quite a bit of freedom, and yet remain true, don't fake.
Well, it's kind of interesting because, although this, come to think of it, has been a chronic problem with classical music for a long time, Beethoven had this problem, and that is, in effect, playing for parties when
yes.
people weren't paying as much attention as he would like. And so there has to be sometimes this little give and take with your slightly inattentive audience in order to get their attention. If you were to play it exactly note for note every time, you might lose them.
And this is not to say, of course, that the famous classical composers did improvise.
Sure.
Often, you know, improvise in the middle of their concertos and so forth like that. But once it's printed, do you say exactly true to it or not? And we no longer have the traditions of the appoggiaturas and so forth, which were taken for granted. If most Mozart writes this note, you play it this way instead, and just quote, everybody knew it.
Right.
We no longer have that tradition, but we might have a few freedoms here and there.
Well, getting back to Scott Joplin then, one thing that intrigues me about the genesis of ragtime is the geography of it. Scott Joplin was from Missouri, and
yes,
I think...
Yes, so this is not New Orleans.
Yes, one or two of the other big three ragtime composers also from that part of the country.
Yes, so the central United States, a little bit more, you know, higher up on the Mississippi River. And since in those days, every home had a piano in its parlor, they could buy music for 5 cents. It quickly became popular, and he made money off of the sheet music that was sold. So, of course, it was played in homes. And this parlor element is also a very strong strain in rags, not only the frighteningly sexual syncopation dance, which might lead to terrible things.
Well, led to some terrible pianists from time to time. But another aspect, I think, that at least I find appealing about ragtime in its earliest forms. Well, first of all, you have nice titles. You have colorful titles. Whether they actually mean anything or apply directly to the music, they're memorable titles. Maple Leaf Rag, Solace,
yes.
Another, of course, example. But the sheet music itself was always so artistic, too.
Yes, uh-huh. And Rudi Blesch makes the point when he prints the whole thing, there are elements which now are would be frighteningly taboo. But he says, if we deny them, we do disservice to history. So the relation of the African Americans to the whites is a very sensitive subject. And sometimes the titles are dreadful. Sometimes they're colorful. But the imagination, yes, they may have no... Lamb, for instance, has an Ethiopia rag.
Right.
Honoring the African syncopation, perhaps, but not necessarily Ethiopia versus, you know, Ghana or Nigeria.
Yeah, <right.
laughs> And one of the most wonderful one, of course, is one that we will play later, modern one, Graceful Ghost, which has nothing to do with sheets and Halloween, but ghost in the sense of the Holy Ghost, which William Balcombe wrote as a graceful tribute to his deceased father.
Yes.
So, Adam and Eve rags, all sorts of wonderful titles. But the basic form was the same.
And with the Maple Leaf, 1899, what suddenly makes this different from, you know, say, popular pieces from a year or two before? Why does it suddenly stand out?
I think everything worked well to make the form very satisfying. First of all, it was rather complex. Maple Leaf and many others not only have four strains, but they're not merely repeated. A, A, B, B, C, C, D, D. A, A, B, B, go back to A, and then your subdominant into C and C and D. And it works magically. It's wonderful. Not everybody does it. Sometimes they will bring A back at the end. But the strictness of the form is surprisingly useful to make it an attractive form. And more so than, for instance, going back a little earlier, Foster songs. They're fine, but they don't have the richness of that is worth going back to.
There may be more predictable.
Yeah, maybe more predictable. A little
more limited in terms of their
scope.
A
little shallower also yeah. in musical ideas.
Right, right.
So even within the strict form of the syncopation, and now if you notice the bass line often in many of these rags, there's almost the implication of a sliding trombone, a little half step sliding up in the left hand that always reminds me that they may have been thinking, could this be orchestrated? And then the trombone would be able to go boom.
Is it back to the influence of Sousa marches, maybe?
Yes.
Band music?
Yes, I think so. And again, before the influence of the saxophone. So this would have been more if it did get orchestrated with violins and clarinets and trombones and stuff like that and a few trumpets. So the form is fascinating. Let me play James Scott to give you some ideas. Again, 16-bar phrases, the obligatory arpeggio. Not only is the 4-bar introduction happens very often. Occasionally, a 4-bar or 8-bar postlude, as we mentioned in the last Scott Joplin rag that I played at the concert. But usually just a 4-bar, perhaps a 4-bar interlude going into the third strain. But what Scott does amazingly well is make the syncopated introduction. You think, all right, that's just an introduction. He uses it precisely as his first tune. Here is the amazing Broadway rag, which he had the courage to call a classic.
This is 1922.
Yes.
Broadway from 1922 by James Scott and Carlos Moser's the pianist with me during University of the Air today. And we'll return and find out about two more of the big three ragtime composers. We'll add a couple to our list, too. All of that after this here on WPR. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Carlos Moser, and we're looking into the world of ragtime as a style of piano that came in, well, you could say pretty suddenly, right around the turn of the 20th century and went out almost as suddenly, oh, when? 1920s, perhaps?
Yeah, 1920, early 20s. As we explored on the other earlier visit with you, it was fading. It had been, conquered the world, Russia and everywhere else, but the kind of pseudo-genre of the Oriental foxtrot took over for a little while, influenced maybe, as you mentioned, by the discovery of King Tut's tomb a little later.
And yep, 1922, the same year the Broadway came.
Yeah, everything from Morocco to China was fair game for making fun of the Orientals doing the foxtrot. And ragtime certainly was eclipsed also by jazz, just the excitement of the jazz, I think, in the 20s.
Well, the big three in ragtime, traditionally, I'm told, are, well, one we've already heard from. That was James Scott.
And Scott Joplin, of course.
And Scott Joplin. So before we get to the third one, what about Scott Joplin? Yeah, I would say that that piece we just heard, Broadway, sounds almost as if Joplin could have written it had he lived another 5 years. I mean, it seems to me that close to the Joplin style.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. He built upon it, as we mentioned earlier, a little bit more pianistic in a way. But Scott Joplin did such wonderful things towards the end of his life, including the opera Tremonisha and things besides the rags. A great favorite, I think, and a surprise towards the end of his life is his wonderful rag Solace.
A Mexican serenade?
A Mexican serenade. The syncopation is there, less perhaps than in some of the others. Still quite pianistic, but smaller scale. And traditional form, A repeated, B repeated, return to A, modulate to the subdominant for the third and fourth stay there. So it ends in a different key from the beginning. That is not, strictly speaking, what classical music does, but it works fine enough in rags. And also unusual here is that he simply puts in a fermata. I don't know.
Okay, you want to. It's a hard thing to illustrate, I suppose. But
you will notice
When we hear it.
We have some flexibility of tempo of. A slight pause before going ahead, and certainly not a jig time dancing type of thing where you would have to go. So,
but the sort of thing that Josef Strauss put into the performances
exactly,
of your
the Chopin
music.
Waltzes, not necessarily to be danced to.
Yes,
the waltz. So the form here gives Scott Joplin a wonderful chance to show his skills and. I'd like to do Solace.
It's a standout. Thank you. Solas, a Mexican Serenade by Scott Joplin. Harmonically, is there a difference, Carlos, between these ragtime pieces and things that had come before, New Ground?
No. I think some of Scott Joplin's later ones do explore suggestions rather than fulfillments. There are many solo lines, unharmonized lines, which can suggest different keys. And he does sometimes in Euphonic Rag, for instance, go to unexpected places. This one does not. It's perfect within its own form. But he was going some places. He wanted to be taken seriously, I think, as a composer.
Yeah, he was in some ways a tragic figure. Actually has this in common to some extent with James Scott, from whom we heard before, and that's this being short-lived.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
Joplin, I think, was just shy of 50. Scott was 27 or something like that.
Amazing, yes. And other composers, I mean, Schubert, Mozart, Gershwin, and all of those.
Yes.
You know, really,
Chopin.
And one wonders where they would have gone on, of course.
Yes, yes.
And I think with Scott Joplin especially, since he was branching out into, he'd written waltzes earlier, but branching out into opera. And again, like Gershwin, who had explored other forms besides his great songs.
Yeah, when Gershwin started out in Tin Pan Alley. And
yes.
Range, and again, in a very short period of time, of course, of just 20 years or less.
Yes, indeed,
so of his remarkable
composing career into ballets and set pieces and operas. Amazing.
Well, so we've mentioned these three big names in ragtime.
And the third name is Lamb, of course.
Joseph Lamb, who was the only white one of the three.
The only white, and fairly early on, I don't remember his dates exactly, but again, found the market, as it were, of the parlor piano, I feel, as had the others too. But certainly this becomes salon music in a way, rather than dance music as such.
So by the time we get to Lamb, and in terms of chronology, we're not that much farther. In fact, this piece that we're about to hear is Ragtime Nightingale is actually earlier than the Broadway piece
yes,
that
was.
We just heard by several years. But is Lamb making this more respectable?
I think definitely so. The title Ragtime Nightingale probably refers to the little in the third strain. But I also heard that he had, when he was asked about this particular rag, he had just heard about a little C minor arpeggio. And he just started with that. And again, like the James Scott, he takes one germ and in much of rags, the little germ is obsessively repeated.
Beethoven did much the same thing at times.
Right. Exactly. One little germ and just repeat it, embellish it, transform it very much. So I think Joseph Lamb knew his audience. Here it's the second strain, which is highlighted rather than the third. And at the end, he brings back the second strain, which is a little unusual because usually the first strain has amazing, wonderful substance. It's balanced off by the second one. But this one, which you will hear, suggests a swagger and a kind of elegance, which is a little surprising. And in some ways, it reminds me of the women's fashions of the time, 1915, the Belle Epoque, the pre-First World War, when the war that had changed everything and, of course, led to immense changes in music and think of the 20s and so forth. But in a way, this is still harking back to a more elegant and wonderful time.
Ragtime Nightingale, this is Joseph Lamb. Thank you. Joseph Lamb, Ragtime Nightingale from 1915. You know, Carlos, I can still, maybe if it were slowed down a little bit, imagine somebody like, a Bessie Smith or a Josephine Baker singing, you know, to that tune.
Yes.
What I can't hear anymore, though, is I heard in some of the earlier pieces that we've sampled, is I can't hear somebody actually dancing to that, though. Now, this is much more pure piano music, it seems to me.
I think so, very much so. And curiously enough, of course, when pieces became popular, they would sometimes have words set to them.
Right.
And, there were words set to these things to capitalize on the popularity. And it doesn't work at all. Many of the ragtimes simply would be very difficult to be sung. But Joseph Lamb is exploring that kind of melodic, as did Scott Joplin in Solace. The singing quality is starts creeping into rags. You yourself had mentioned in one of your stories about how Artur Rubinstein and Stravinsky talked about his ragtime, written in 1919. He possibly was jealous of the attention ragtime was getting and hoped that his music would also be that popular. But his ragtime piece for 12 instruments, while interesting, I think, is a little condescending and trying to show off. And as Artur Rubinstein pointed out, it's not very melodic.
Let's see, I guess I'm trying to think of other composers, classical composers, who
yes.
would have at least dabbled in ragtime.
Yes.
Charles
yes.
Ives, maybe.
Charles Ives may have had some ragtime ideas. Charles Ives, such a controversial, interesting figure, so imaginative in his manuscripts difficult to read, and little notes on the side. At one point, he said, "This note to be played on Saturday nights only." And this arbitrariness, I think, if it crept into Ives, it was surely just part of his panorama of Americana. Only with William Balcom, I think, do we get modern serious. And Balcom is still alive and certainly has explored all kinds of music. His work with the rags has been quite amazing, and it was started quite early on.
And we're going to hear from William Balcom. We're going to hear from our very own Carlos Moser, too, who's more than dabbled in this ragtime genre. All of that right after this. This is University of the Air on WPR. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Carlos Moser, who is taking us through the wonderful world of ragtime. It's been a genre that's had this rather curious life cycle in that it's very popular first 20 years of the 20th century, went into kind of a sleep for some 50 years, perhaps, and then in large part because of the popularity of the movie The Sting, which uses it kind of anachronistically, we have this great resurgence in the 70s, and that's where we find ourselves now, about 50 years down the road from where we left off. And one of the practitioners of ragtime in the 70s, none other than Carlos Moser. Now, how did you approach it?
Well, again, thanks to Rick Mackey, who showed me his treasure trove from Tulane Archives, Tulane University. We explored together much of the music of the early 1900s. And when he got me to play rags, I was charmed by the fact that I could play simply the music that was written, not have to improvise in any way, and found their form very attractive. So by 1978, I'd played solo rag concerts and also had the rags which were orchestrated and we had played in our Hyperion Orchestra. So I wrote Eros, as in the god of love, piercing, with a slight pun on the automobile of the period.
Not Pierce Arrow. Oh, sure. I'm sorry, I missed that
Eros
completely.
Piercing with his arrows. A rather strict form, classical form. three strains. The first one repeated, the second strain repeated, then the first one again, modulating. It's strictly an A minor. You can hear the beginning and the end. It has a four-bar intro, four-bar interlude, four-bar postlude, and, of course, going to the subdominant in the middle. A kind of romantic sound for the with slight syncopations. But although it is tonal, and certainly anybody who finds my chords a little Ravelian, I don't deny.
Well, you know, you could do worse for an influence.
Yes. And he wrote a beautiful blues movement to his violin sonata.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. Honoring it, I think, rather than condescending to it. I also introduced the octatonic scale. Whole step, half step, whole step, alternating, so you have eight notes to the octave rather than only seven.
So play it's, one of those for us. How does that sound?
Only three are possible, and I use them all. So in a way, this piece is a little more erudite than lovable.
No dancing, no singing.
No dancing, no singing. I hope the tricks are well hidden enough. Another trick that nobody has ever noticed is that the first strain, although the piece is in A minor, the first strain is played in three different keys. And I won't even tell you what they are.
These are not simultaneously.
No, they appear three times in three different keys, but end properly where they should. So, again, we take a little motive, syncopated, and like many rags, almost obsessive in the various strains. So I hope you can enjoy it without knowing why. Eros piercing.
Thank you.
Bravo.
Thank you.
Yeah, I can see where that might be a little hard to sing.
The no, key is it's constantly... a piano rag. It's definitely a piano rag. But I welcome the strictures of the form.
So how did you go about actually composing? I mean, did you have inspiration? Did you have this motive that then you built on? Or was this just really more of a mechanical process?
I do not consider myself a composer. I did some composing, and I had spurts in my career where I did more of one thing than another. My career started, as a matter of fact, with a composing career, with writing a little ditty for Mamie Eisenhower.
Nope. How straight. That's got to be a whole hour in itself somewhere.
No. Very short. I was in the Army during the Korean War and near Washington, so a group of us wanted to go to the White House to visit, and we couldn't during the regular hours. So they opened it on Saturday for five of us just to visit the White House because it was not the usual time. And my artist friend did some Mamie Pink or something like that, and I wrote her a little ditty. We didn't, of course, get to meet her, but this was my tribute there. I was more influenced by Rogers than by Ravel.
Probably all for the best.
also good. So these spurts of composing and the rags interested me. I would not say I was so much inspired as charmed by the hard work of using my motives, what I had, the more lyrical contrast for the third strain, as I wanted to do, and working in the octatonic, which is even in places like... Yes. You see? So those little ideas are... Still is some of the octatonic. And... inspiration is overrated.
I have heard that said in various forms by composers.
The hard work and, let's say, the enjoyment of what works is.
That's satisfactory in its own right.
Yes,
right.
So the rag has really not interested many people. As we had mentioned, Balcom, and I think even Kit Taylor was charmed by Balcom's rags. I would like to speak to him about that someday. But Balcom knew popular music so well. His songs are so marvelous, managing to be approachable and yet always fresh. And he wrote some rags in the late 60s and 70s, and early 70s, even before it was popularized by the movie.
Yes, I think... probably his most famous rag, Graceful Ghost, is from 1971.
71, I think. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
Oh, it has a wonderful lilt to it as a rag somewhere along the line. Sure.
Yes, it certainly has the syncopations. He uses the form very well. Again, not particularly a piece to be danced to. As we mentioned, it is a tribute to his deceased father and a very graceful piece indeed.
Graceful Ghost by William Balcom. Thank you. Graceful Ghost by William Bolcom. And our guest today has been Carlos Moser. Thanks for joining me and guiding us through just a few of the ragtime highlights.
Rags are wonderful.
I'm Norman Gilliland, and this is University of the Air.